Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Jack Lepiars. Tonight, we have a lecture presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program titled The Radical Possibilities of Black Studies. Our speaker is Dr. Kehinde Andrews, Professor of Black Studies at Birmingham City University, Birmingham, England. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, African American Studies Program Director Louis Chudi Soke.
We're welcoming tonight a truly remarkable and notable scholar, activist, and bona fide public intellectual. I say bona fide because the term public intellectual has suffered from some overuse and misuse these days, but so is the term activist. Right. With our guest today, Dr. Kehinde Andrews, those terms are given new legitimacy and urgency due to his commitment to using black studies as scholarly, academic, as well as engaged institutional and popular action. He's currently professor of black studies at Birmingham City University in the United Kingdom. And it's important to note that Birmingham City is the first university in Europe to offer a black studies degree. And so Dr. Andrews is often referred to, and I think it's actually technically true. You're the first black studies professor in the UK?
It's not true.
A white woman who doesn't do black studies. Oh. It's a long story.
That sounds
long.
Don't
want to talk about.
He is director of the Center for Critical Social Research, the founder of the Organization of Black Unity, and co-chair of the Black Studies Association. His work includes 2013's Resisting Racism, Race Inequality in the Black Supplementary School Movement, 2018's Back to Black, Retelling Black Radicalism for the 21st Century, a book that has been generating a good amount of conversation, debate across the Atlantic. He's got a forthcoming book called The West is Built on Racism, and he's the editor of collections including 2016's Blackness in Britain. His public work ranges quite a bit from venues like CNN, The Guardian, The Independent, Washington Post, New Statesman, Black Scholar, and other places. But I want to encourage you all to take a look at his TEDx talk from 2017, which is called How to Stay Radical Within Institutions. Right. So let's please welcome tonight Dr. Kehinde Andrews.
Thank you. Thank you for the introduction. Thank you for the invitation. The talk today is The Radical Possibilities, and I would put possibilities in scare quotes because it really is a conversation about, you know, can you have a radical anything in a university? So actually that TED talk that I gave, I think I was maybe a bit more positive than I actually am, because there is a contradiction between radicalism of any kind and being an academic, if we understand what the academia is. So with black studies, for me, I always talk about it as a experiment, right? Can we do the work that needs to be done? And if it can't be done, we shouldn't be afraid to say we should leave the academy. I mean, that's kind of the conclusion which I always come to, but I get paid too much to leave. So, I mean, that's also one of the issues as well. So thinking about black studies, this is the 50th anniversary year of black studies, and you have black studies here for, you know, that's 5 decades, and in the UK, it's a stretch to say we really have black studies because we have one degree program. So technically, I am not the first professor of black studies, although morally, I guess everybody considers me the first professor of black studies, because the first professor of black studies was actually a white American in Edinburgh. And like I said, the work isn't really black studies if we think what black studies is. And I'll talk a bit about this distinction between African-American studies and black studies, because black studies really should have a different methodological, epistemological approach that actually African-American studies can have, but doesn't usually have, I'd say, as well, probably. So that's part of the discussion about what do we mean by black studies, and I think that's some of the work that's been done now to really think. On both sides of the Atlantic, so what's the title of the special issue?
Yeah. What was black studies?
It's given up 100%. What was black studies? So I think now people are really reflecting and saying, well, 50 years later, what could it be? What should it be? What went wrong? Right? It seems to be the idea. And so in the UK, we've been heavily influenced by what's happened here, but all in a good way and a bad way, right? So what are the lessons what can be learned, what don't we want to do, as well as what do we want to do, right? So that's, I guess, the context for the talk. So we do have the first ever degree in Black Studies, 2017. So that was when this degree started. We haven't actually graduated anybody yet. The first graduating cohort is this year, because it's 3-year degrees in the UK. Actually, one of the major differences is that we don't have major minor. You sign up for a Black Studies, you just have to major in Black Studies. That's what it is, which, as you can probably imagine, makes a problem trying to recruit people, right? Because, you know, you really have to get 17-year-olds who are convinced they want to do Black Studies, which is that's an issue, right? But so this year we'll have a first graduation of Black Studies students. And honestly, that the students are something which has just kept me going over the last 2 or 3 years, because it's been very, very difficult institutionally. But the students, they've been amazing. Like, the students who are drawn to the course, what they want to do, the kind of things we get them doing as well, really has been transformative, at least at that level, I think. So when we're thinking about what Black Studies is, I do think we have to spend a bit of time thinking about America, obviously, because America is where Black Studies emerges. And if you think about the emergence of Black Studies in the 60s, there really was some kind of radical demands, right? So Nathan Hare writes a paper, The Battle for Black Studies, in 1970 so, right? And if you actually think about the Black campus, the Black Revolution on campus is what Biondi calls it, you know, it really is militant, right? The movement for Black Studies here is militant, right? It involves sit-ins, protests, occupations, the occupation of Willard Strait Hall, where students had to arm themselves because they were in fear of their lives, right? And there's that great picture where they come out armed to the teeth, right? That's an image that you just don't get in the UK for many reasons. We don't really have guns in the same way. And also, we don't really have the history of... Well, we sort of do have history of protest, but it's a very different kind of history. So actually, establishing Black Studies here was a battle. It really was, you know, San Francisco State College had a 5-month-long strike. I mean, you shouldn't underestimate the amount of effort and energy and mobilizations and movements, but predominantly from students, student-led, that got Black Studies onto campus. Because of that militancy and because of that history and because of that battle, there is a tendency to look back and say, well, look, this radical moment of Black Studies. But I want to rethink that a little bit. Because if you actually think about some of the demands, they may never have been that radical in the first place, and this may actually be what the legacy of the problem that we currently have, right? One of the things I write about a lot in Back to Black is that we conflate radicalism with the mechanism, right? So if it's militant, or if it's loud, then it's radical, which is not really how we should see what radicalism is. This is not a definition of radicalism. The most violent, militant system that's ever existed is Western capitalism. It's a status quo. It's killed more people than anybody else. Jeez, it is nice definition militant, right? But it's also obviously the most liberal as well. So when we're thinking about defining radicalism has to be defined by those politics that want to overthrow, that want to overturn, that want to do something fundamentally radically different. Now, in some of the early calls for Black Studies, you can see that, right? So Abdul Al-Kalimat talks about the science of liberation. Hare talks about the community component, the idea that education for liberation. So you see those ideas are very much there. But also, if you look at actually what the demands for Black Studies were, really, they're about how do we get space access onto predominantly white campuses. So Black Studies does not emerge in HBCUs, right? Still actually is the majority of historically Black colleges don't offer a major in Black Studies. This is an experience of predominantly white institutions. And if you think about what happened is, the 60s is a time where the universities widened participation here, opened up, you've got women, you've got working class people, you've got Black people onto campus, and we're coming onto campus and then we're looking at what's being given to us and saying, well, hell no, this is terrible. What is this, right? What is this whiteness? We can't accept it. And so actually, if you look at really what the key demands were for Black Studies and the students, it was recognition on the campus, right? It was a foothold in terms of staff, in terms of knowledge, in terms of courses, in terms of experience as well. So the student experience really was this kind of, we want a place here. And that's been the big success of Black Studies, African American Studies, which is now, you know, routine. It's all the top, every university, basically the top universities. I was invited to Harvard to do Black Studies, part of their Black Studies seminar series. So, you know, this, in terms of its key demand, it gets exactly what it wants, right? The question we have to ask, though, is that demand enough? Is that demand radical? And is actually that demand the problem? Is that why we find ourselves where we find ourselves today? And the UK, we're in a very similar situation, right? So our widening participation happens later. It hasn't just happened, it's really 92 onwards. So 92, there's a kind of expansion of universities. Actually, my university became a university in 1992, and there's a whole range of universities become universities in 1992. And now black students in the UK are overrepresented in higher education. And again, we're on campuses, and we're looking at the curriculum, and we're seeing what's being taught, and going, maybe not, right? So in the UK, there's student mobilizations. Why is my curriculum white? Starts in 2015. Why isn't my professor black? Starts at the same time. There's Rhodes Must Fall. I don't know if you heard Rhodes Must Fall, trying to bring down the statue of Cecil Rhodes at Oxford. So there's really is big student mobilization, and the universities have now picked this up and are responding. So there's a drive to decolonize the university, what they call it, decolonize the curriculum. The government's using this language. The universities are picking it up, having decolonizing away days. Sorry, I'm laughing because thinking about words being misused. Decolonize is a revolutionary term, right? We're talking about complete transformation. But actually, in this context, decolonize does not mean that at all. Decolonize in this context means to diversify, right? Can we get more black staff? Can we get more black people on reading lists, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, it's become kind of an industry for, I'd just say, I'll be honest about it, it's a common industry for white scholars to kind of make money diversifying the curriculum, right? Let's bring Fanon into the curriculum. Like, this is a solution to the problem of the university. So in both spaces, you're seeing the same problem, basically, right? Lack of access, students coming onto campus, and you're seeing a similar kind of response, which is how do we get a more diverse set range of ideas, range of people, etc. Now, in the UK, it's terrible. Like, it's really bad if you look representationally. So, as I said, this really, I'm probably the only authentic black studies professor in Europe, is how I would put it. But if you look at the just generally the workforce, so only 1% of academic staff are black in the UK. Was not that many of us in the UK, but we're about 3% of the population, so significantly underrepresented. Higher you go up, it's even worse. So out of 19,000 full professors in the UK, there's 126 black professors out of 19,000. I mean, it's like 0.6%, something like that, of which less than 30 are black women, right? And when you then go down to black British-born, it's even less. So it's really, really, really small number. The numbers are very, 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 very small. And then if you go to the people who run universities, management, it's just basically all white people. Like, literally, I have been the most senior black person at my university since I started at the university. Like, literally, I'm the ceiling of seniority in the uni, which is crazy because I only started there 5 years ago, right? But there just isn't that any diversity at the top. So there is a massive issue with diversity. The other thing they've started to do now is kind of token academic appointments. So there's very few black academics. The University of Manchester is one of the worst places for employing black professors. And they've literally, just in the last year, appointed two. You can look it up if you want. I won't name them because I actually know both of them, and this isn't a personal thing. But they're more celebrity, like public figures of blackness, like TV journalists. And one of them is a professor of sociology at Manchester. And you're like, this is not how you solve the structural problem of there being a lack of black professors. You surely should promote the people who've been working in the field for years and years and years and years and years and need to be promoted. Instead, it's kind of this celebrity, let's get the celebrity professor and make our statistics look a bit better, right? That's how the universities in the UK are dealing with the problem. So it is a really big problem. It's a serious problem. And there's a lot of arguments for diversification. But the problem is diversity can't solve the problem of the university, right? It really can't, because the problem of the university is the university, it's the structure of it, it's what it is, it's how it works, it's how it functions, it's its history of how knowledge is constructed, it's the whole structure of universities which creates all of the issues the black students face when they come into the university, or black staff face as well. And it goes back to a quote which I wish I'd come up with, but I didn't, by someone called Deepa Nayak, where she says, "The university is not racist, the university is racism." And this is how we have to think about institutions which we are part of, right? I mean, if you think about the idea that most of us in the room weren't fully human beings, I mean, when does that really become codified into knowledge? In Western, in universities. Not even in the religious days, it was it was all about the soul, and it wasn't about biology. It was a kind of this moral thing about who can be godly, if you like. And the assumption with the Enlightenment or science is that, you know, you leave behind these kind of old ideas. Strangely enough, they just take the old ideas and actually make them more concrete, right? So it gets linked to genetics and to the body and to biology. And really, I mean, the Enlightenment structurally is effectively a exercise in white supremacy, right? It is white identity politics coded into the philosophy that we still use. Right? We still use these same ideas, right? So if you're trying to trace back the history of racism and how racism gets embedded, I mean, the university is the space, the site to do that. Legitimizes it through science, knowledge, and still today actually legitimizes it through science, knowledge as well. I won't go into this, but if you're really interested, you can ask me. Because the book I'm writing now, we changed the title to Empire 2.0. And it really is about how the West is built on racism. And the argument being that, you know, old style empire has ended, which was direct violence, nation state colonization led by Europe. And we're in a new version of empire, which is America-centered, globalization. But again, still has the same logics, right? The same logics still apply of white supremacy, of colonial violence. It's just run through a different way. And if you actually look at global inequality, you can quite clearly see that the white supremacy from the Enlightenment is embedded into our political economy. What's the poorest continent in the world? Africa. Where's the richest places? Where white people live? That's the hierarchy. Black at the bottom, white at the top, everybody else in between. This is the political economy. So this isn't just ideas. This is a way of structuring and creating what the world is. And that is the world that we inhabit today. Right? And nothing in our universities that we have done so far has fundamentally challenged that idea. In fact, if you actually look at the knowledge base of both of our universities, it's the same kind of ideas, right? The defense of thinkers like Immanuel Kant, who basically gives you an architecture for a universalized racism, right? But we kind of reject, actually, I'm going to go into a little bit, right? So the chapter I wasn't going to go into, but the chapter I'm writing currently is called, the last chapter is called I'm White, Therefore I Am, right? And this really does, this is the conceptualization of European philosophy, right? So we take Kant, for example, the defense of Kant, which I always thought was suspect. And before I started writing the book, I kind of knew a little bit, but I knew the big notes, but didn't know all the details. When you actually read the details, my God, it's terrible, right? Kant's awful. I mean, I was just really going, what is this? Like, jeez, how can anybody defend this? But actually, Kant actually writes a advice of how the best way to punish a slave is. Basically says you should stop using a whip because African skin is too thick, so you should use like a flat piece of wood and to bleed out the African. This is the person people are defending. Like, really, you have to think about why we've forgotten that Kant was a complete and utter self-avowed racist, right? And the defense usually is, well, you know, yeah, he was racist, but his moral philosophy was great, right? So it's okay, we can separate these two things out. But actually, Kant himself says you can't separate these two things out, right? How Kant's basically, half his back catalogue is what he calls moral geography. And moral geography is racism, right? Like, Africans are inferior because they're in Africa, Europe's better because of the climate, et cetera, et cetera. But the reason you can't separate them out, because Kant says, look, the reason I can theorize the critique of pure reason is because of my position in the moral geography. Africans can't give you this because they are inferior. It's a structurally racist idea, but in its definition, right? And this is the knowledge we've basically kept, right? We've basically gone along with, right? Where does knowledge come from? It comes from here and it spreads out, right? And actually, if you think about even the contemporary debates, they're very, very similar. Unfortunately, even the lefty debates are very, very similar as well, right? So I wasn't even going to talk about this. I started ranting on about this, but I think it's important for making the argument about what the university is. So something like Marxism, which I have a lot of time for, right? But Marx should be seen as an Enlightenment scholar, right? Marx doesn't disagree with any of this, right? Basically says, yeah, it's all the same. Basically says, yeah, capitalism necessary. Capitalism is progress. There's just something after capitalism. So Marx is just as embedded in the Enlightenment in thought as anybody else. And what we're currently having is a sort of Enlightenment 2.0, where you have right-wing arguments about where the future goes and left-wing arguments about where the future goes, but they're all structured in exactly the same way. Right, I've read it. This is the chapter I'm currently writing, so I'm in it at the minute. All these lefty thinkers in the UK, I've been mostly reading like UK people. I don't know, has this come over here yet? Fully automated luxury communism by Aaron Bastani that made it over here yet. But if you actually read, like, writes a whole book about capitalism in the West, doesn't mention slavery, colonialism, racism, what? Not in it, literally nothing. Like, it never happened. Right? A whole version of history that just forgot, literally forgot that slavery, colonialism happened, right? Which is really odd. But there is this idea that where does progress come from? It comes from the West, and it spreads out. Right? Really, those are still really deeply ingrained in our thinking. So, all that to say is, if you look at the intellectual heritage and architecture of what the university is, it hasn't really got any better, right? It just looks a bit different. And so what happens when we diversify is we bring people into this bubble and teach them the same things, right? Teach the same logics. So this can't be what we need, because that's not going to give you revolutionary education. Because actually the university is the pinnacle of a really racist way of thinking, right? And a really problematic conception of knowledge, society, et cetera, et cetera. And actually, more than anything, that knowledge base is what needs to be destroyed. Right? If we're thinking about overturning, if we're thinking about decolonizing, if we're thinking about revolutionary knowledge, it's not going to come from the university because of what the university is. So there is this tension with trying to bring people in to diversify. You think about the university is effectively what makes it so problematic, and how these knowledges have been able to be kept and to just repeat effectively is because of the separation of thought from action. Again, a very Western idea, right? I think, therefore I am. We have credibility as scholars because we're detached, right? And we're outside and we're above and we can look down on the rest of the world, right? Because of the insularity of universities, this kind of knowledge can continue to circulate and be reproduced, right? So think about how did I get made professor? I got made professor for not really any of the public things that you mentioned. It was all of academic journals, right? People writing in journals that people can't access if you're not part of the bubble. And even if you could access, I'm pretty sure nobody would want to read any of them, right? Because of the way that we write and the style of it, right? Talking at conferences, right? Going into academic conferences, again, where only people in the bubble can talk and can peer review. Another one, everybody's inside. If you think about the metrics that get us or get you tenure or get you a job, all of those metrics are internal, right? All internal to the workings of the bubble. So if the knowledge at the heart of that is problematic, this is what sustains you, then it's always going to be self-referential, self-sustaining, etc., 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 right? And this is why it's so elite and so problematic, and this is why the knowledge from universities is deeply problematic. And if you think about something like how race is theorized or how blackness is theorized, you see this very, very, very clearly. So when I first... I did psychology undergraduate, so I missed out all of sociology of race, didn't really get to it. When I got to it in graduate school, I read it and was like, what the hell is this? This is nonsense. Like, I literally was reading it like, I don't understand how anybody could think this was the way that racism could be conceptualized, right? But it became very clear at that point, because all of this conceptualization was done totally separate from the lived reality, from the lived experience. Peer review, internal conferences, writing for the particular audience, right? So there's a number of scholars I won't name, actually, but I could, who reify that kind of European way of thinking about difference, right? So the best example for this probably would be blackness. So I write about blackness, right? Blackness, black unity, black radicalism, black as a concept, right? So if you think about how that's been treated by academics, there's a book by Essayon Udom, who wrote Black Nationalism in 1970, and it's actually about the Nation of Islam, of all things, which is a hugely problematic organization, I won't go into it now. But the book, but in there's this bit where he's talking about the academic, the black academic, and why the black academic can't connect to the public, that doesn't understand it. And there's this really nice passage where he's like, the problem is that because of the way that European scholarship has understood race as a concept, we've all ran away from it in academia. We don't like it. We're not happy. Even when we use it, we kind of use it like sparingly, like we don't really like it, right? Whereas in the struggles for resistance or in a community, blackness is, it's not complicated. It's not controversial. It is the tool that's what unifies and mobilizes people. And if you can't get to that tool, then you can't understand the people, right? And there's this big distinction. And you really can see it historically, not completely, but you certainly can see it in UK scholarship now. And there's a whole bit in the book where I talk about this real strong divergence. Why don't people like black consciousness? Well, the reason that academics don't like black consciousness is because we've done a really simple mistake, right? We've conflated race with blackness. which are two different things, like two actually different concepts, right? Which have a shared history. They have some, there's some interrelation to them, but they're different concepts. So race is this European concept, this European construct, which, you know, is based on what Cedric Robinson calls the Negro, right? In order to exploit us and to enslave us and to colonize us, they kind of have to imagine that we're subhuman. That's the Negro. Negro has no history, no culture, no civilization, right? This is, the Negro is a hugely important concept for the political economy, right? Because in order to have slavery, you have to have the Negro. In order to have colonialism, Jim Crow, etc., you have to have the Negroes, etc. In order to continue to steal resources out of the African continent today, guess what else? You need the Negro, right? It hasn't gone anywhere, right? It's still very clearly in the conceptualization. Look at mass incarceration in the United States. Look at just how crazy it is. African Americans have been treated by the courts. It didn't make any sense, right? You can only really understand that through the idea of the Negro, people as being subhumans. So look, yes, we want to get rid of that concept. Of course you do. It's a terrible concept, right? But one of the things that Western conceptualization of knowledge do is they put on a pedestal Western conceptualizations of knowledge. This is what difference is. This is how blackness is seen by Europe. This therefore must be what it is. This is not true, right? There is an alternative history of blackness. If you say blackness, this color, the hair, whatever, the physical markers of difference that we have embraced for centuries as a tool to resist European constructs of race. Right? So one of the ways to think about this is on the slave ship, right? So when they took Africans, they purposely mixed us up into different tribes so we couldn't speak to each other, right? This may well have been the first time that we thought of ourselves as one, because before, you know, but when you just got black people, it's just like, whatever, like, you're Igbo, I'm Yoruba, etc., etc., right? So this may well have been the first time we'd really conceptualized a kind of African or blackness, right? But that doesn't mean that the conceptualization of it was defined by whiteness. Right? This is a very different thing to say, right? So when we find ourselves in a battle of a slave ship with different tribes, etc., etc., and say, well, actually, look, this, there's something that we need to unify around our shared location and position, unify around our shared African heritage, right? We're not doing that on the terms of Europe at all, of whiteness. We're doing that on our own terms. And you see that there's a tradition of blackness which is all about history, it's about Africa, it's about shared experience, doesn't involve genetics, doesn't involve biology, doesn't involve hierarchy, doesn't involve any of these things that race involves. That's a revolutionary concept. But because we put race on a pedestal, Europe on a pedestal, we've ignored our actual own generative theories and ideas, right? If you throw out blackness, you've thrown out the revolutionary thing that brings us together. And this is what academics have been unable, not all academics, obviously it's a bit general, but largely black academic scholarship has been unable to really deal with, right? So there's a book by Kwame Appiah, In My Father's House, which was really popular, I believe, in the... Appiah, sorry. No, he did just... okay. Not that. And he has this whole rant about Du Bois. Du Bois isn't radical. That's another conversation, because when I say that, people get mad. Du Bois is not radical. But you can ask me about it afterwards. But Du Bois, his whole rant where he's ranting about Du Bois using the term blood. There's a common blood. At Garvey, you'll see that blood. You'll see blood. Blood's often used, right? And when you go to Europe, you can't say, but you say blood in Europe, everybody goes mad. Like, it's just like, what, blood? Because of blood rights and Nazis and et cetera, right? But again, Europeans have used blood to mean a particular thing, to mean genetics, biology. What blood means in this concept is simply like family. Like, it's my kin. Like, that's my kin. That's all it means. It doesn't come with the rest of the things that it comes with when you have race and white supremacy. But there's, again, there's a complete... There's actually a phrase in the book where he says, somehow Du Bois managed to talk about blood without maintaining versions of white supremacy. So he actually got it. He had it. But then went on and said, oh, yeah, but that can't be done. Right, but it was done. He even gave you an example of it having been done, right? So there's this whole history of us using this idea of this connection to each other to be something which is the basis of a radical revolutionary politics, right? That's what blackness is. That's actually what should underline black studies. For me, that's the most important concept. Yeah, that's the most important concept in black studies, right? The connection of the African, Africa and the African diaspora. Because that has that connection makes, is generative in it by itself. Right, because if we see ourselves as connected across the diaspora, then it changes the way in which we analyze and understand society. So one of the big problems with European scholarship, Western scholarship, is what Herminio Martins calls methodological nationalism. Right, think about how we actually everything's national. We have a national class schema. Right, we have a national race data. We collect data here and compare nationally America to Britain. Everything's chopped up nationally. Right. Which is ironic, given that we don't like to give too much credit to social constructions. The nation state is a social construction. We talk about the nation state like it's a real, natural, this self-occurring thing. Nation state is a complete creation. Creation is a myth created and banded in order largely to control people, both here and especially in the colonies and former colonies, right? I mean, to talk about a Nigerian nation state is madness. I mean, that's a total creation of Europe, right? And if you look at the map of Africa, you just see clear all these straight lines. The craziest one is Zimbabwe, which just has this bit that just juts out randomly. If you look on the map, it juts out into Mozambique. And the reason is because Cecil Rhodes really wanted that bit. He said, I really like that bit. So that's what I'm going to have, this little bit that juts out, right? So how does it make any sense to have a Zimbabwean analysis of the state? Because it's not a legitimate thing. It's a social construction. We're giving it far too much credit, right? So one of the things which really, and early Black studies really was predicated on this, was this idea of Blackness in its diasporic global understanding. Because once you do that, you actually have to analyze things very, very differently, right? One of my favorite people from, no, not one of my favorite, my absolute favorite person historically, and who I consider one of the most important intellectuals of the 20th century, is Malcolm X, right? Actually, this may be a record for the length of time of me talking and not mentioning Malcolm X. So, and what does why does Malcolm resonate so much? Even now, I mean, I read Malcolm at 16. You got kids, you take the Ulberg and Malcolm X anywhere, and people will pick it up, read it, and they'll just be transfixed by it, right? Why? Because Malcolm has an analysis which is predicated on global. There is no such thing as an American problem, there is a world problem, right? Actually, the experiences that you have in America and the experiences I have in Britain, the experiences in the Caribbean, the experiences in the Congo, are actually all connected, right? What's the problem? Global white supremacy. Black at the bottom, white at the top. And that manifests itself differently here, and differently in different places, but actually the problem is exactly the same. It has the same root, right? The same basis. And so when we're trying to understand Blackness, then we have to understand Blackness globally, not nationally, right? And this is really important not just the politics of it, but also the knowledge that is produced and generated, et cetera, et cetera. One of the things that happens to Black studies very quickly is Black studies switches to African-American studies. And actually, African-American studies, I would contend, and people please push back on this, these are different things. Right? Not just in title different things, but by banding the African-American experience as central to the discipline, it does change the nature of what we're talking about. Blackness as truly diasporic, as the basis of what we do, versus a focus on a particular region. One of the reasons we didn't call the course Black British Studies, you very, very rarely hear me say Black British at all, is because of this. We're saying, actually, no, conceptually, it must be diasporic. If you come to our course, we're drawing on America, we're drawing on Caribbean, we're drawing all the time, Africa, we're drawing on Europe, we're drawing on different parts all the time, because that is really important to how we generate a particular kind of knowledge, right? This is a sort of unfair comparison, because, so in the UK, we do have African studies and Caribbean studies, and people have pushed back on us and said, well, look, that's not, this, Black studies isn't new, we had this before, but really, these are very, 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 very different things. So the history of Caribbean studies and African studies in the UK, those are actually colonial disciplines. Those are area studies, anthropology, this kind of really, like, how does Britain look out at its possessions, basically? And if you look at the intellectual heritage, it's really terrible. I mean, today as well as any other period in time, and African studies in America will be exactly the same. There's a reason why last year, 2 years ago, they founded African Studies for Africans Association. Because still, the discipline is still defined by this kind of white gaze, right? So I've been to like one Caribbean Studies conference, and I would never go back again. And it wasn't just partly it was the intellectual production was being done, but partly the organization. So there was this dinner, and I'm not joking, the dinner, the chair, the head, the people who really run, everybody was white. And I'm looking there like, well, this actually feels like colonial Jamaica. Why am I coming into this space, right? So we created Black studies because we didn't have a space for the scholarship that we wanted to do. Now, again, that's not a real fair comparison to African-American studies. African-American studies isn't a colonial discipline. It is generated from the experiences, from that student mobilization and movements. But the area, by nationalizing it, there is an issue. I mean, lots of African-American studies departments do have kind of diaspora elements to them and do have put them in there. But we'd have to ask a serious question: to what extent has that kind of American exceptionalism seeped into what Black studies is? And I have to say, actually, one of the, I've had a lot of conversations where it comes up a lot. It comes up a lot. And I was surprised, actually, because actually, outside of the US, actually, the conversation really is diasporic. So if Brazil, if you go to South Africa, if you go, maybe not Nigeria, maybe a bit international. If you go to Europe, certainly, there is a really kind of this diasporic idea. And many of the conversations here, too. But there is also a kind of stubborn American exceptionalism. And, I mean, you can see it with ADOS, American Descendants of Slavery movement, which I've heard way too much about since I've been. I've only been here for like 2 days, and I've heard it a lot, right? So one of the things about thinking about where does Black Studies go, Black Studies really has to go back to that diasporic, that truly diasporic understanding, right? I mean, even in like understanding what America is, like America, is the blackness in America is a really diasporic experience anyway. Right? Well, who's one of the most influential movements for African Americans was the Garvey movement. I mean, the Universal Negro Improvement Association was the biggest black organization here and globally, and influenced pretty much everything else that comes after it. Nation of Islam is heavily influenced. Some of the organizing, the civil rights movement is heavily influenced. The Panthers take influence from that. Malcolm's basically a Garveyite. Even take Malcolm X. So I love Malcolm. And one of the pushbacks we get in the UK is, well, why do you always look at Americans, etc.? Like, in what way is Malcolm American? He's born in America, fair enough. His mom's from Grenada, right? Both his parents were in the Garvey movement. Was it Stokely Carmichael? Kwame Ture says, like, Malcolm's basic philosophy is Garveyism. So if you actually look at organization of Afro-American unity, the work he's doing when he dies, this is pure Garveyism, really. And where does he get the idea from? From his five-month tour of the African continent, right? Actually, comes out of a meeting, it's like a three-hour meeting with Kwame Nkrumah, and then he decides we're going to found the Organization of Afro-American Unity, which is modeled on the Organization of African Unity, right? So actually, if you look at the intellectual ideas, what's being put forward, it's not American at all. In fact, Malcolm tells you, you're not American. You're an African in America, right? Which, again, is part of that appeal. So when we think about what America is, you really do need to think about, actually, America's has taken influence from different parts of the diaspora. That influence has gone to, even back to Africa, and then come back as well. So there is no black experience which is British or American or Jamaican or national. The black experience has always been this kind of mixture of all these different things, which makes a lot of sense given just how important movement and mobilization has been across the diaspora. So that's a really important concept of the things that we want to bring in. Thinking about not wanting to diversify, but to actually transform what the university is, part of that is a knowledge thing, right? So to bring in different forms of knowledge, different kinds of knowledge. And Hare talked about the community component of this, right? And the community component often gets, I don't want to say reduced, because actually the one of the biggest parts of Black Studies is that it has to go into community, can't just be stuck in the university campus. Remember, the separation of thought from practice has to go into the university. But the community component isn't just about kind of that service learning model. It's more of an organic connection that puts us at all times and the work that we're doing in service of community. That's what science liberation is about. But more importantly, the community component also, relates to knowledge, right? It is about theory and what theory is generated and what theory do we teach and what is the canon. So the intellectual heritage of Black Studies in the UK is nothing academic. It's all about community knowledge, right? So Black Studies is new to the university. It is not new in the UK. So if you go back 50 years at least, we've had our own schools, Saturday schools, voluntary organizations organized by parents, community organizations, etc. The big thing about the Black Power movement in the 60s in Britain was all about knowledge. It was about different way of thinking. It was about black bookshops and black organizations, community education. Anyway, I learned everything I learned about blackness, about actually everything I talk about today and I get paid to do now, I did not learn from school or university or college. I learned it from community. I really did. Like the books on my parents' shelves, the interactions with people, et cetera, et cetera. This is a complete different lineage of what knowledge is, right? So when we're thinking about how we transform one of the unis, we have to transform our knowledge base. We shouldn't be afraid to say things like Malcolm X is the most, if one most important intellectuals of the 20th century. Claudia Jones, one of the most important intellectuals of the 20th century. And if you think about it, until relatively recently, all of black intellectual thought was outside the university because there were none of you couldn't be in the university, right? Like we just wouldn't really have a choice. One of the negative things which has happened because of the incorporation, I think, of African American studies, is that we now see the site of the university as that legitimate site for knowledge in a way that we never saw it as a legitimate site for knowledge before. In fact, it was the opposite. We probably saw, we suspected the black academics because of that, because of their location in the university, right? I'm not saying we should all, I'm a black academic, so I can't say that's the role, but we should be critical, right? And we should be really saying, well, where are those community intellectuals? Because the reason that someone like Malcolm or Claudia Jones is gives you a better knowledge, I would say, is because they are directly involved in the struggle. It comes from the struggle. The audience to which Malcolm's talking to is thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of people in the grassroots. That's where those ideas get tested against. And those ideas, that's a better place to test these ideas than in the bubble, to other academics, peer review. That's how could you possibly have a good, it's not going to lead to, that's not the peers that you need to be reviewing your ideas, basically. One of the main things we've done with black studies before we had a degree was you just kind of opened up the space to community. So we just have, it's just hundreds of people from the community all the time, right? My inaugural lecture is next week, and it will just be all community. There'll be a few people from the university, but it'll be mostly people from the community, because that's our audience, in a way. Like and that's where we test the ideas. And it's a different, so when you come to, if you come to PCU and present, it's a completely different, you might get booed, you might get heckled, people will laugh, it's different, but that's actually, because it's so different, it means that you have to approach the way that you do work differently. The way that we talk has to be different. The way that we engage is different. It's just completely different. And that's the kind of knowledge which can really organically connect. That makes sense. It's not less rigorous. It's just different, right? So the audience is really, really, really important. What else is more important? The other thing which is important for black studies, I think, and thinking about disciplinary, right? Because one of the things we tend to resist is disciplinarity. You know, black studies is interdisciplinary in its nature, and that is one of the benefits of it, right? But if you just create black studies as a space for the black stuff, that's basically the ghetto, right? Any black stuff you just put in black, that's not what we should be saying. We should be saying that, yes, the black stuff is important, but what's the methodologies of black studies? What distinguishes black studies? It should have it has to be interdisciplinary, but there should be an epistemological, methodological claims which are different. And part of that claim should be that black studies has to be involved in changing what happens outside. That's the other important part of the community component. Has to be involved in changing what happens outside, right? So, for example, on our course, we called it a placement because that's what university understood, right? But really is go and apply black studies, go and work in a community organization, go and test your ideas, see what happens, see what goes on. In our third year project, we've made it mandatory. They have to go again, work with people in the community. I mean, it can be a theoretical thing, but at least go and talk to somebody. Like, at least go and think, share your ideas outside and see what feedback you get, right? Because we're saying that element should have to be there in any black studies, I think, because we should be thinking about what's the new epistemology of black studies. And I think that's one of the areas of work we should go into. There is, thankfully, some precedent to this, right? So actually, if you think about black feminist epistemology, black feminist thought does a lot of this work, right? Right, this really is, and black feminism is not definitely the biggest body of academic black studies, by a distance, I'd say, probably. And its impact has been huge on this, right? So if you think about Priscilla Collins' work, the idea of black feminist thought, the standpoint, that's really what we're saying with blackness. There's a standpoint of the diaspora which brings us in, which you can see the world from a different place and create different theory. And the epistemology, there's a term Priscilla Collins uses, the ethic of personal accountability, which is really powerful to this, right? Why is it that people are suspect of academics? Because it doesn't seem like we really care, right? The dispassionate observer. The amount of times I've been to a university and spoke, and people have been like, oh, you're very passionate. I'm like, well, why on earth would I be doing something if I wasn't passionate about it? What would be the point, right? But that seems to be what the expectation is, right? And also the ethic of personal accountability, people only trust you if you're with them, if you're there, like if you're doing things. So that, again, puts us in service of the community. I mean, that's really what we're talking about when we say like something like the science of liberation, right? And this is effectively, I think, what we should be trying to do. It's the metaphor I use for black studies is that there is this movement to decolonize the university, but I'd see it very differently, right? The university is what it is. It's not going to change anytime soon. It's the way it is because the role of the university is to underpin a racist status quo, right? That's what it does, right? To expect us to be able to change that without having a revolution, and I usually do argue for revolution, but if we're not, this is to say the revolution hasn't happened, you can't decolonize the university. What you can do is you can colonize the university. And this is what we've done. We've created a space within the university where people have got jobs and we've hired and we're doing some interesting work and we're connected to community and we're literally just taking resources out all of the whole entire time. And that's the project. Can you colonize the space and do something differently with it? Right? That's actually one of the things which frustrates me, I think, about, I don't want to say all African-American studies because it's not all like that, but I've been to African-American studies departments where you're like, I won't name this university, but I will tell what happened. So I was in a prestigious university, has a reputation for being, every time I mention the university, oh, that's radical, it's radical. My experience is completely opposite. This university had loads of money, like massive amounts of money. So much money that one year the dean called in the head of the department and said, you've forgotten to spend $675,000. I was like, what? I don't even know what that looks like. We never had anything like that, right? I mean, it's forgotten to spend, right? So the head of the department goes around to everybody else, all the people in the department, says you can have $75,000 each, spend it on whatever you want, right? Half of them can't think of anything at all to spend it on. It's just like, oh, I don't know. Yeah. But the worst part of the story, I'm sitting, is me, the head of the department, and a young academic not from that university. The young academic's first response was, I'd have bought some furniture. And I'm there like, where would that even cross your mind? Like, what was that like, about buy a leather chair? Like, I really don't understand. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. With kente glove on the back, right? But he's like, to me, it's mad. I'm just sitting there thinking, this is insane, right? All the resources could do anything you want, because this is the one thing about our job. You really can do basically whatever. There's some things you have to do, but we have a lot of flexibility, right? They could have spent that money on anything. But the idea you would spend it on community was just completely absent. In fact, the conference I was at, they must have spent at least $30,000 on it, so I assumed it would be like a big thing. It was like an internal seminar, because people in the department weren't getting on. So they thought, let's invite some scholars from around the world, have a couple of days to talk. And I'm literally like, this is insane, right? So one of the things we think about and that's like the worst vision for black studies. That's where black studies goes in the UK. That's not what we want, right? Because we're just replicating what white scholarship is. When we should be saying, actually, let's transform it. And we do have the possibility. And here, more so, in the UK is just us by ourselves with very little resources. But here you actually have this massive opportunity to really actually say, well, let's do the methodology differently. Let's make these organic links to community. Let's literally just take out these resources and put them in service of the community. It's a real possibility in here. But the problem is, I want to end positively. Yeah, sort of positive. Okay, I want to sort of end positively. It's a bit negative, but the problem is, if you look at, in order for us to climb the ladder, we find that we get further and further and further away from the people, right? To do the things that we need to do still, like, you know, you can only have the flexibility to do these things if you progress up the bubble, and progressing into the bubble means not doing the things that you want to do. So it's difficult, right? We're actually asking people to do things that don't really make logical sense given the profession that we're in, right? So it is not simple. It's not a personal critique. We have to be realistic. And I think that's the struggle. But I think one of the ways hopefully you can overcome that is by the collective and kind of really trying to say, I think this is the challenge for the next 50 years of black studies, is to try to live up to those radical demands. Because it is sort of possible, hopefully, but it's only possible if we decide that that's what we need to do. That actually we decide that this is what's really important. And we are in a moment, I think, of reflection where we really can do that. And I'll stop there.
All right, thank you. I'm curious. You've been really good about not naming names. And I'm not going to pressure you to name names. But as you answer this question, just know I know the names you're not saying. And I actually want to get at that. One thing you haven't really talked about is the role of the 80s UK black and the emergence of cultural studies / black British cultural studies. Yes. I'm curious about your take on that and its relationship to black studies as you engage it. And certainly the question of blackness is crucial to that conversation, but I want to hear it from you, what you think.
So
without naming names.
Without names, we'll get name names. I mean, Gilroy is obviously one of the names. I mean, geez, I don't even know. What. Paul Gilroy is obviously huge in that discussion, right? And there is this sort of problematic way that blackness gets thought out in that moment, I think. In some ways, not. So in some ways, actually, the point is to make kind of cultural connections. You know, the Black Atlantic is the idea that, you know, there's cultural connections across the diaspora. But it gets done in a way, and even Stuart Hall. So actually, Stuart Hall, who I have a lot of time for, actually, in terms of hybridity and new ethnicities, and stuff, is guilty of a similar thing, right? Which reifies the European idea of race and says that actually we need to have this more hybrid, more post-colonial, more post, not even post-colonial, post, post-modern subject, which is more fluid, et cetera, right? Which is so, true to some extent, right? But it takes blackness away from its political roots and orientation, which I think is really, really, really problematic, actually. And one of the things that that line does of hybridity and new ethnicities is it kind of takes away from the idea of black consciousness. So for me, black consciousness is absolutely essential. Black consciousness is more than anything, black consciousness is the thing that we need, right? That's the thing which unifies, opens up the diaspora, radicalizes our politics, because it says that even though my material position may be completely different, because of black consciousness, I'm connected to the child that picks out the coltan in Congo for my mobile phone, right? So it's actually a real radical, black consciousness to me is absolutely essential, the most important thing. And that whole agenda of new ethnicities, hybridity, etc., really, and does, in by intent, tries to say, well, actually, you don't need black consciousness. You really don't need the black consciousness with these new, I don't know, post-colonial subjects, right? But the problem is the world hasn't changed. The world hasn't changed at all. The world is, you may think that and idealize that in these academic spaces, but the world is still as the world is. The Negro still exists. It's still a creation. So the reason that blackness came into being is still necessary. So it's too far too early to move away from that. And I think that's my problem with that. That I would think.
Wonderful conversation. And thank you for coming.
No worries. Thank you for coming.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Kehinde Andrews, Professor of Black Studies at Birmingham City University, Birmingham, England. Dr. Kehinde Andrews' lecture was titled The Radical Possibilities of Black Studies and was presented by the Boston University African American Studies Program. Tonight's moderator was African American Studies Program Director Louis Chudi Soki. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You can also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from Matt Lissette. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydodes. I'm Jack Lepiars. Thanks for joining us.